Okay, here we go. Stand by. 3, 2, 1, action.
Assume nothing.
Rash, bald-faced blasphemy.
Question everything.
I find it extremely hard to imagine.
Open your eyes.
It is quite all right to be an atheist.
The fastest growing group of people in the country has been measured as being those who have no belief or who are atheists.
You don't have to be apologetic or quiet about it.
Challenge the opposition.
You see religion on 100 fronts losing the argument.
And start thinking. This is The Thinking Atheist Worldwide.
Dr. Mark Leary is a professor of psychology and neuroscience at Duke University. He's an expert in human emotion and behavior. He's got a lecture at the Great Courses Plus. It's called Mysteries of Human Behavior. Why do we think what we think? Why do we do what we do? How are personalities developed? Why can people genetically similar be so wildly different when it comes to their interests, their attitudes, their temperament, etc.? What are the roots of things like maturity and friendship, love, the darker shades of the human condition like prejudice and hatred? How do we better understand the machine of the mind as it relates to our daily lives? Mysteries of Human Behavior is a wonderful lecture series, one of over 8,000 lectures at the Great Courses Plus on topics ranging from science to religion to history to travel, hobbies, the arts, and so much more. Unlimited streaming or download right to your computer, laptop, tablet, or smartphone. A wealth of knowledge at your fingertips. I want you to try the Great Courses Plus, so they're giving my listeners unlimited access to watch all of their courses free for a full month, but you have to sign up through my special URL. Start your free month right now. You'll love it. Go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/Seth. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/Seth. You want to make sure and join us next week. I'm doing a show on secular millennials. I know many people blanch at the term, at the label millennial. We're going to get into all of that, or at least most of that, next week. And we're going to do a show that talks about this curious generation and its increasing lack of religiosity. Its lack of religiousness, the fact that it seems to be operating more and more well outside of the churches and religious institutions of their parents. An interesting show about secular millennials. If you have a perspective on this, you can email podcast@thethinkingatheist.com. Later on in the month of September, I'm going to be talking to Catherine Osmond. She is author of a book called Grace Without God, talking about finding meaning and purpose in our lives outside of religious models. I know we covered this from time to time, but I just always like to come back to the notions of self-generated purpose and how do we frame these things and how does ritual and tradition inform and improve and impact, in so many cases, the human condition. Why do people crave church and the structure of church? And for those who leave the church, what happens next? I'm going to talk to Catherine Osmond about that. It's going to be a fascinating discussion later on in the month of September. Today's broadcast is a discussion with another fascinating special guest. There is video of our conversation, which took place on Skype. So if you'd like to watch this episode as well as listen, or instead of listening, you can just click the link, which is in the description box of this broadcast. One of the amazing things about doing what I do is from time to time, quite often, I get the opportunity to meet people who have some pretty amazing backstories. They've extricated themselves from religion. And Jehovah's Witnesses, well, that's a religion we haven't spent a lot of time on. We're going to do that today. We're going to share the story and perspective and activist work of a specific ex-Jehovah's Witness. His name is Lloyd Evans. He is an author of a book called The Reluctant Apostate, a blend of personal memoir and reference work on the beliefs and the history of a faith that he once held dear. He is founder of a website, jwsurvey.org, which I will link in the description box, and he joins me via Skype here. Lloyd, it's great to talk to you, my friend.
It's an honor to be with you, Seth. Thank you for having me.
Where are you based right now?
I am joining you from Croatia, actually.
There's a lot. Jehovah's Witness and Croatia are not two things I normally just naturally associate.
But like Coca-Cola, Jehovah's Witnesses are everywhere. That's the thing. Yeah. Well, almost everywhere. And Croatia is one of those countries. And I describe the backstory a little bit more in my book. It was basically coming to Croatia that helped me to wake up from my indoctrination. Because I found that when I was obviously Jehovah's Witnesses go to meetings twice a week. And when you go to those meetings, I guess it's true with many forms of fundamentalism, repetition can make human beings believe outrageous things. But when you have that repetition interrupted, i.e. by moving to a country where none of it makes sense anymore, that can play havoc with the indoctrination. And basically 4 months after moving to Croatia, I was more or less in the early stages of waking up.
How do you deal with all the Jehovah's Witness jokes? They always start with why a Jehovah's Witness knocks on your door, and I just hear them everywhere I go. Even in the faith, it's got to be a thing, right? Come on.
Yeah. Oh, well, when you're a Jehovah's Witness, you're familiar with all those jokes, and you know, you're familiar with the names that you get called as well. I mean, I heard pretty much all of them, especially growing up as a Jehovah's Witness, because then you have to go through, of course, the whole process of being bullied for your beliefs in school and having to deal with that side of things. So, oh, yes, you name it, I've heard the joke.
Did you feel empowered as an agent of God? I'm being persecuted for my faith, or did it just suck? You know, oh, shit, they're going to come after me again. How'd you feel about that persecution?
Well, Jehovah's Witness kids are basically taught that they should view school as their own personal territory. So when Jehovah's Witnesses do their preaching work, they are literally assigned territories. They have little maps printed out telling them what streets they should focus on. And basically witness children, they're not given maps, but they're told, well, you know, your school is a like a territory that the rest of the congregation doesn't have access to. So you're not just going to school to learn, you're going to school to teach. You're going to school to let other children know, and possibly your teacher know, the good news, and to possibly save them from Armageddon. So you are very keenly aware of that responsibility as a witness child.
So in that way, they're recruiting children for the mission field, and the mission field is their school.
Precisely, yeah. There's even some fairly recent material that's been published by Jehovah's Witnesses. They have a new channel called JW Broadcasting, and very recently, they published some footage about evolution, where children are depicted speaking to their classmates about evolution. I think it's a music video, if memory serves. I'm a bit fuzzy on that, but you know, quite frequently, witness children are reminded of this duty to basically go behind the teacher's back and, you know, let their classmates know that evolution is a false teaching.
Lloyd Evans, I know in your book you sort of laid out the foundation of Jehovah's Witnesses for those who are watching and would like a primer on it. And what sets it apart from the Mormons, from Christianity? Give me sort of the Jehovah's Witness 101 here on Skype, would you?
Okay. I had quite a nice conversation with an ex-Mormon recently. I think we both agreed that though Mormons and Jehovah's Witnesses look very similar, there are a lot of differences between the two religions. Basically, the dogma and the theology is completely different between those two faiths. If I was to describe the Jehovah's Witness theology as succinctly as possible, Jehovah's Witnesses believe that we are living now in the last days, that these last days before Armageddon began in 1914. They believe that between 1914 and 1919, Jesus inspected the religions of Earth and, surprise, surprise, decided that the Watchtower Bible and Tract Society in New York was his favorite religion of them all. And having made this selection, he bestowed upon the leaders of that organization the mantle of the faithful and discreet slave, which is a terminology from Matthew chapter 24, where Jesus is basically giving a parable about who would be taking the lead in administering spiritual food. So Jehovah's Witnesses are trained to believe that from 1919 onwards, the Watchtower Bible and Tract Society has been God's one and only true religion, God's one and only faithful slave administering spiritual food to mankind. They also believe that if anyone who isn't a Jehovah's Witness will be destroyed at Armageddon, which is imminent. So I realize that's bad news for you, Seth. I did want to break you in lightly there.
What's that t-shirt that says I'm going to hell in every religion, right? It is what that's it right. is. Now, is it that's true right. that only 144,000 are supposed to achieve heaven, or is that a misconception?
That's actually true, but there's a caveat, which is that Jehovah's Witnesses have like a two-tier form of Christianity. So most Christians believe that when you die, you go to heaven. So when Jehovah's Witnesses say only 144,000 are going to go to heaven, that doesn't mean that only 144,000 are going to get saved. They've believed ever since the 1930s that there are basically two forms of Christian. One is an anointed Christian who gets to live in heaven, and that number cannot exceed 144,000, and they get to rule as kings and priests with Christ. They believe that everyone else who's a Christian, and obviously there are 8 million Jehovah's Witnesses on the planet right now, so that's a huge surplus. They believe that everyone who survives Armageddon as a Jehovah's Witness and isn't going to heaven is going to live forever in paradise on earth. Well, I call it a paradise. I think of it more as a dystopia, because you've got to live for the rest of eternity on a planet that has been landscaped over the corpses of over 7 billion people who were killed in Armageddon, and praise eternally the God who perpetrated that act of genocide.
Another version of holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty, who was and is to come. When they talk to me about heaven, what do you get to do in heaven? And there are so many different versions. Everybody's painting their own portrait. But one commonality is we get to just sing and praise to God forever. That's our privilege. And I'm like, can I go to hell? You know, that is not an option, because heaven does not sound like a party to me.
Yeah. No, but isn't it interesting? I mean, I know that you have a fundamentalist background as well, which is one of the reasons why I'm privileged to talk to you, because there's lots of activists doing this, but I'm always thrilled when I get to speak to someone who knows what it's like to really, really believe. And, you know, isn't it interesting that we were able to kind of bring our minds into this attitude that, yes, this would be a really enjoyable thing to do for the rest of eternity, just do nothing but, you know, praise God and live this very sanitized existence where there's no risk, there's no danger. Everything just, you know, happens in this very controlled way.
I remember asking people to describe heaven, the landscape of heaven, the climate of heaven, and it was almost like asking them to describe the face of God. They would really paint a lot of themselves into it. You know, you could really see them. If it was important to them to be reunited with loved ones, that was what heaven was. And if they wanted music, that's what heaven was. And if they wanted other things, that's what heaven was. You can see them informing their own ideas of heaven.
Mm. Yeah, well, it's interesting because the Bible doesn't say much about what life in heaven is like. I mean, there's some fairly interesting visions in Revelation, but apart from that, there isn't really that much to go on. And it's a little bit like that with Jehovah's Witnesses with their view of paradise. On the one hand, they're supposed to look forward to it and kind of salivate over this future vision for the planet. But if they go into it in too much detail, it kind of starts to unravel, because, for example, they believe that the animal creation will revert to how it was in the Garden of Eden. And they believe that in the Garden of Eden, no animals ate meat. So they all ate from the vegetation. And, you know, anyone who knows anything about biology and zoology understands that that's just absolutely preposterous. I mean, what will the sharks be eating? What will the poisonous snakes be eating?
And vegetarian kind of lions and tigers will
precisely
be out there with some tofu. You know, I totally get it, Lloyd.
So the more you think about it, the more it unravels. So what you'll commonly find when Jehovah's Witnesses are talking along those lines is that the conversation will reach a certain stage, and then they'll start saying to each other, oh, but we really shouldn't speculate. We really shouldn't speculate. So that's as far as it goes. You know?
You said we're both children of fundamentalism. Was this a product of your mother and father, Jehovah's Witnesses?
Yes, very much so. I was raised by I was a third generation Jehovah's Witness on my father's side. The organization got into my dad's family in 1953. With my mother's side, it was a little bit more recent. She kind of got roped into it through a series of circumstances. But I was definitely raised from very early on to take it very seriously. The example I give in my book is what I call the Armageddon drill. So one evening, it's customary for Jehovah's Witness families to have what's called family worship sessions, which are essentially just child indoctrination sessions. So the parents will get together and they will basically teach the children using either a book or some other form of reference, or get them to prepare talks, whatever. And my dad decided that to be a little bit imaginative, and he basically faked a phone call in front of us because it wasn't too difficult to make the phone ring by itself. And he made it sound as though he was receiving a phone call from his congregation elders to alert him that the Great Tribulation had begun, the Great Tribulation being the prelude to Armageddon. And basically, we all had to gather our belongings hastily and get in the car and drive to a nearby forest where we were to meet with the rest of the congregation and hide from the worldly authorities under Satan's control. So, but he conveyed all this in a way that I totally believed it, which is kind of, in a way, I feel as though I've lived through Armageddon, because I've lived through the first few moments of genuinely believing that it was about to happen.
Yeah, your father was Orson Welles doing War of the Worlds back on radio. You know, it blows my mind. It must have blown your mind as well. Holy shit, this is really going down.
I genuinely believed that this was Armageddon, yeah. So I raced upstairs and I was throwing all of these belongings of mine into a rucksack. At the time, I was heavily into Enid Blyton books, so I was throwing in binoculars, magnifying glass, penknife, you name it. I was also throwing in, you know, books that I'd come to revere as a young Jehovah's Witness, one of them being a book called Revelation, Its Grand Climax at Hand, which was a then newly released Jehovah's Witness book that was talking all about Armageddon. I figured it would be a useful field guide for what was unfolding before me. But obviously, when I came back downstairs, it was obvious from the looks on everyone's faces that I'd been had. But that was the sort of seriousness with which my family raised me to believe in Jehovah's Witness teachings.
Speaking of book, what is the book for the Jehovah's Witnesses? Do they rely on the Bible or something else?
You can't see it here. I've got a bookshelf behind me. Basically, if you go on my channel, John Cedars, most of my videos I film in front of my bookshelf, and you'll see it's basically a multicolored array of books stretching all the way back to the early 1900s. And basically, they release a book almost every year or every other year. It's constantly changing, but it's one of the kind of inside jokes for the XJW movement, is that Watchtower is constantly coming up with new light, because they obviously publish books that say, oh, Armageddon's just around the corner.
Let me stop you right there. New light is when the Jehovah's Witnesses change their doctrine or narrative because something else kind of didn't work out, is always how I had interpreted that. Is that what new light is? Elaborate.
Yeah, so new light is literally they believe that they've received new light or new enlightenment from God. They're very careful with their wording, the leadership. So they don't say that they are inspired of God. They say that they are guided by God's Holy Spirit, which to me means exactly the same thing. But they basically say that they're guided by God's Holy Spirit to interpret the Bible. And it just so happens that the Bible apparently tells us that the last days began in 1914 and that there would be a short period of time between 1914 and Armageddon, a short period of time that's now, what, 103 years and counting? Yeah. But basically, they've been caught out throughout their history, going one step further and kind of pointing to a specific date or a specific time period. So two very good examples of that were in 1975, where they singled out 1975 as the year for Armageddon. And obviously that didn't come to pass. So immediately they, in the immediate aftermath of that false prediction, they started saying, well, it wasn't that we let you down. It was that you guys took what we were saying too seriously, that kind of thing.
How dare and you then, take us literally?
Yeah, yeah, you weren't supposed to believe us. Yeah. And well, when I was little, when I was growing up, we were told that the generation that witnessed, that were cognizant of the events of 1914 would not all die off before Armageddon came. And that was the teaching I was raised with. And they very, very subtly got rid of that teaching and replaced it with a very convoluted teaching that I won't bore you with that basically makes no sense whatsoever. It's called the overlapping generations teaching. So they've come up throughout their history with all sorts of convoluted explanations as to why it's taken so long for Armageddon to come after 1914. And again, every time they come up with a new explanation, it's new light.
I call these things apologetic acrobatics. Forgive me for interrupting you. You were explaining the books behind you then. Are these all revisions to the doctrine or teachings? The books behind you are sort of a 2.0 and 3.0 for Jehovah's Witness doctrine?
Yeah, so basically, when you know about the theology, you know how it's changed over the years. So the books from the late 60s through to the early 70s are kind of geared towards the 1975 teaching. And then after that, they're geared towards the generation teaching that I just told you about, but they're released on a variety of subjects. So they might have one, for example, on the family. They might have a book that's just for young people. They released a book in the 1970s, which I was forced to read, called Youths, Your Youth Getting the Best Out of It. And one of the pearls of wisdom in that was that masturbation was tantamount to homosexuality, or that if you masturbated, you would become homosexual. So that's the sort of wisdom that you have to get used to when you read the books. I mean, I keep hold of them because they're absolute gold for proving how nonsensical witness teachings are. But in actual truth, they're not worth anything to read. They're basically nonsense from cover to cover, all of them. But I use them for purposes for which they were not intended, basically.
Word salad by the Jehovah's Witnesses, yeah.
Precisely, yeah.
Let's come back to the 144,000. Am I door knocking my way into heaven? I mean, is this salvation by works in that way?
Okay, so when you get called on by a Jehovah's Witness, they are not interested in getting you into heaven. They're interested in getting you through Armageddon and into paradise. And basically, I mentioned before about the two-tier Christianity. That changed in 1935, because before 1935, the witness movement was very small. In fact, it was known as the Bible student movement up until 1931. Then in 1931, due to various schisms, it was rebranded as Jehovah's Witnesses. And in 1935, the leader then, Joseph Rutherford, he was like the second charismatic leader of the movement, a bit of the Brigham Young character. I like to think of him as like a David Miscavige to L. Ron Hubbard, that kind of character. And he came up with this revolutionary teaching to explain for the fact that there were only a few tens of thousands or maybe a couple hundred thousand followers, and yet there were supposed to be only 144,000 who could get into heaven. So where do all of these excess believers go? Well, in 1935, he came up with the brainwave that only 144,000 would go to heaven, and everyone else who was being preached to by Jehovah's Witnesses would inherit eternal life in paradise earth. So it was kind of created out of necessity more than anything.
Would that have been considered new light then, if he had come forward with that?
Yes. Oh, Judge Rutherford was a genius at coming up with new light. He had all sorts of crazy ideas. One of his ideas was that his house, which he had built for him, it was a mansion in San Diego, cost a fortune to build, but he justified it by saying that before Armageddon came, Bible characters of old, such as Moses, David, and Samson, would be resurrected just before Armageddon, and they would need a place to stay, obviously. So no, this is all true. So he willed his house, which was called Beth Sarim, he literally included in the will the names of all these Bible characters and said, well, this is their house, and I'm just kind of the housekeeper for the
weirdest reverse mortgage ever, right?
That's actually crazy. A little known teaching that not even many Jehovah's Witnesses know about, that because it's been very well hidden in the history of witness literature. But again, it's something I can prove very easily using my bookshelf. So
okay, so I hear the knock at the doorbell and I go down and it's you, okay, back in your Jehovah's Witnesses day. Why are you here? You're here to help get me through Armageddon, right? To get me to paradise. What does that entail? Are you getting me to say a prayer? Do you want me to become a Jehovah's Witness? And how is that done?
Ultimately, the goal, Seth, is to turn you into a Jehovah's Witness. And the way that's done is, usually it's done, first of all, by trying to interest you in the Watchtower Awake magazine, or in some kind of leaflet or brochure. You know, presuming we can move you along quite quickly, we'll get you a little gray book that's called What Does the Bible Really Teach? Well, it's gray, but some editions of it are yellow. And it's a fairly thin book, but it's basically designed so that you go through it with us, and you basically have to agree with every single paragraph in the book. So we will literally ask you a scripted question at the end of every paragraph, and your answer must align with what's written in that paragraph. So it's actually better, for example, for you to read verbatim from the paragraph than it would be for you to say something that doesn't agree with what the paragraph says. So once we've been through that book, you would basically be encouraged to start coming to the meetings. The more you come to the meetings, you would start joining us in the preaching work. After you've started joining us in the preaching work, we'd send an elder to go through some questions with you. Depending on how you answer the questions, it would be arranged for you to get baptized. And that's basically how it would work. Can't believe I've just described it like that. That sounds creepy.
Do you ever have any weird encounters? Did they invite you in and you were like, you know, something odd, something marked you, whether it was a bizarre encounter or someone got angry, anything like that?
The weirdest encounter that never happened was that someone said, yeah, sure, I'll have a Bible study. I mean, in all of my 10 years of preaching for 70 hours a month, I never got someone to say that to me. I did have lots of very, very friendly people who, you know, invited me in. Believe it or not, that does happen, where people invite you in and they bring you coffee and tea, and you end up spending ages in there talking. There are people like that, but it's very, very rare to get people to agree to being Jehovah's Witnesses. And when you're doing it, you can't understand why it is, because it all makes perfect sense to you. It's only when you get out and you realize that Google is literally heaving with information that completely debunks your beliefs that you think, oh, that was why, you know?
I remember when I spoke to, you mentioned David Miscavige. I interviewed his father, Ron, who's in his 80s.
Oh, right. Yeah. Yeah.
And so, you know, Ron is still in the Church of Scientology and he's kind of disgruntled about a few things, but he finds himself with sort of unfettered internet access. It's unfiltered. He can actually go and see beyond the sort of virtual walls of the Church of Scientology. And before he knew it, he was an apostate. Right. Mm. Information is just so close if we can just get it in people's hands. And on top of that, make them receptive to it. I mean, there must be a lot of people in the Jehovah's Witness Church who have a tremendous desire to be Jehovah's Witnesses. They fear annihilation. Is it hell or annihilation for Jehovah's Witnesses?
Destruction at Armageddon.
I mean, destruction of the body, but is there eternal torment or anything like that?
They don't believe in eternal torment. You're basically on the end of a fireball, and then it's done, you know?
And there must be many people that you've encountered who the facts won't matter. It just splashes right off of them because they take comfort in being one of the chosen few.
Yeah. Oh, no, it's an uphill struggle. And there, I often say there's no magic bullet to lift decades, years or even decades of layered indoctrination. It's interesting you should mention the internet, because I know in the Sea Org, I've spoken as well to Chris Shelton. He's done quite a lot of work on Scientology, and I remember him talking about how he first managed to stumble on certain websites through getting his own internet key and using it kind of covertly outside of Scientology's reach. But what's interesting is that with Jehovah's Witnesses, I mean, your average Jehovah's Witness has his own unfettered access to the internet that's not monitored or controlled by Watchtower in any way, shape, or form. They are just terrified of going on websites like mine, because when you're a Jehovah's Witness, you believe that the minute you start entertaining anything that's so-called apostate, well, you know, you almost imagine a lightning bolt to come through the ceiling and burn you to a crisp there and then. That's the level of fear you're talking about.
I've got some family members. I'm almost positive that they sort of block their children from seeing the work that I do.
Really?
To me, it betrays, I think. Well, I mean, they don't like have a filter, an actual filter, but they're like, don't go there. Don't bother. Don't waste your time. And I think it betrays a tremendous insecurity about their own position. I would think if you were really right and the facts and the evidence were totally on your side, you'd welcome all comers, right? You'd be like, go read any website you want. I mean, it's no contest. The fact that they are, I don't know, they're so terrified of being introduced to a disagreeing idea, I think is hugely telling. I don't know if that's
true. Yeah, that was one of the most heartbreaking things when I was first leaving the organization. So I have a dad and a sister who are JWs. My mum sadly died when I was 21, which I write about in the book. But when I kind of decided, my wife and I decided that we were going to break free from Jehovah's Witnesses, it was because we were expecting a child, and we thought there's no way in the world we're going to even remotely risk her getting tangled up in this religion. So we decided to make a clean break. And I can remember trying to sit down with my dad. We had him, he came for a holiday to see us in Croatia, and I sat down with him. And I managed to get through maybe a couple of newspaper articles. But then his words were, I feel nauseous. I think I need to go to bed. Thank you for showing this to me. And he literally, you know, scarpered. And that was, after that, it was just made clear that he would be shunning me. And I, especially now I'm a father, I look back on that conversation and it doesn't compute, because I'm thinking, well, hang on, if I absolutely was convinced that I had the truth and we're talking about no longer seeing or speaking to each other, I would be saying, listen, we're going to sit down now and we're going to thrash this out, because you can bring it, because I'm absolutely convinced I have the truth. And nothing, you can bring your worst argument and I will be able to refute it. But like you say, they're terrified, absolutely terrified of subjecting their beliefs to scrutiny.
Lloyd, have you been shunned by your father?
In the process of being shunned as we speak, yeah. And what's really heartbreaking is that he still hasn't met his granddaughter. So my little girl, Jessica, she's got a picture of her granddad in her bedroom, and that's all she knows of him. Because he's never met
the rest of the family. Are they connecting at all, or are they locked you out as well?
Yeah, so I've got a sister. Things are very, 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 very slowly improving there. But essentially, we are still being shunned. I'm hopeful that things will improve with time. Certainly with my dad, it's full on shunning. And basically, with everyone who I grew up with, all of my sort of friends and family members, because obviously you have extended family as well. You have aunts and uncles and cousins and what have you. None of them speak to me. So it really is total shunning, because that's what they're commanded to do.
Is this an edict then? You say handed down by the church. This is policy. If someone leaves the reservation, they are shunned.
Yeah, it's very much a policy. Again, just to compare with Mormons. So from what I can understand, when it comes to Mormons, their attitude towards shunning is it's kind of like an idea, like an unspoken rule. Nowhere is it kind of codified. So there's always the possibility of more liberal families, you know, not shunning because they're not ordered to. But with Jehovah's Witnesses, you are very much ordered to. It's actually a disfellowshipping offense to speak to a shunned person if they're not your family member. But even though it's not an official disfellowshipping offense to talk to a family member who you're supposed to be shunning, it's repeatedly written in Watchtower articles. I mean, there was one Watchtower article, I think, in 2013 that said, don't even email a disfellowshipped family member. And just last year at the conventions, Jehovah's Witnesses were shown a series of very emotional videos depicting, for example, a disfellowshipped daughter ringing her parents on the phone. And you see the mobile phone in the kitchen, and the parents can see it ringing and they refuse to pick it up. And anything could have, and it's a fictional portrayal, but anything could have been happening to that girl when she was ringing her parents. They're not going to pick up the phone. And that's the level to which witnesses are expected to shun.
Is your father afraid that being your father, the father of an apostate, and communicating with you is going to cost him heaven? Is that the deal?
You would honestly have to ask him. Probably, yes. Probably, because... you know what it's like when you're a believer. You really do take it seriously, and Jehovah's Witnesses are taught to believe that. I mean, there are 8 million Jehovah's Witnesses, but maybe not all of that 8 million are going to make it through Armageddon. You know, maybe we can kind of narrow it down even further in terms of percentages as to which of those 8 million are really faithful and really take it seriously. And when you're a Jehovah's Witness and you believe Armageddon's just around the corner, you will do anything, including cutting off family members, to make sure you make it through and to make sure you maintain your loyalty.
Coming up after a short break, I'm going to ask Lloyd, get the story about his escape from the cult of the Jehovah's Witnesses. What were the keys to the door, the exit door, to the JWs? What happened? We're going to get that and talk about a whole lot more on the other side of this. Hang on. Don't forget, my patrons on Patreon get a totally commercial-free version of the broadcast. They also get a bonus broadcast, an extra show just for them every single month. My beloved patrons on Patreon, thank you. Your support makes a huge difference, and I thank you for it. If you'd like to become a patron, it's patreon.com/Seth Andrews. I'm talking here with Lloyd Evans. He is an ex-Jehovah's Witness. He is also founder of the website jwsurvey.org. As someone who's been deconverted, I'm always interested in deconversion stories. How'd you get out? What happened?
Well, again, it was moving to Croatia that was really instrumental. I'd kind of worked my way through the ranks as a young JW. I was an elder by the time I was 28. I know in the Mormon religion they have really young elders, but to be an elder at 28 in the JW religion is, you know, quite something. So I was kind of doing okay. And then a series of situations, basically my wife and I had some marital problems and I decided to stand down as an elder, and we decided to make a clean break, and we decided to move to Croatia, which is where my wife's from. And within 4 months of moving to Croatia, I've managed to find a letter, because obviously it was so emotional and my memory is quite sketchy, but I actually managed to find a letter that I'd written to my wife, because it was such an emotional thing, where I literally said to her, I think I'm going to end up leaving Jehovah's Witnesses, because that literally in that 4 months, my faith evaporated, because I was left not being able to understand the meetings. You're supposed to go to the meetings twice a week. And I was sat there in my chair thinking, hang on a minute, what do I really believe? And of course, all of these suppressed doubts that I'd had ever since I was a young JW started coming back. And you think, well, you know, surely it's worthwhile just really examining this properly and making sure I'm doing this correctly and making the truth my own, which is the way Jehovah's Witnesses put it. And yeah, I ended up waking up.
How bought in was your wife? Was she traumatized by the news, or was she relieved, or what?
It's a very stressful thing, actually, for a married couple to go through. And I was very fortunate. I have heard lots of horror stories of it not working out that way. And especially when there are children involved and there are custody battles and all of this sort of thing, it can be very, very ugly. I mean, we didn't have a child involved at that stage, but I had been lucky enough to marry someone who was genuinely intelligent. I know intelligence isn't, you know, a huge amount to do with indoctrination, but she was intelligent and she did genuinely care about not being lied to. She didn't like being taken for a fool. And I just kind of pursued a very softly approach, where if I was genuinely thrilled at some new discovery, I would share it with her. But otherwise, I just left her to come to me with questions as to what I was going through. And just by following that process, she ended up waking up maybe a year behind me. So we got out together.
Waking up is a great way to put it, isn't it? I think I've used the analogy that, for me anyway, for many people, it's fast. I always envy them. Oh, it only took me a month, you know, 2 weeks. But for me, it was like coming out of a coma. It's not like in the movies.
Yeah.
Somebody wakes up and they run track immediately, you know. For me, it was sort of these degrees of regaining consciousness and getting clarity of vision and, you know, working your muscles and reintegrating with the real world. I mean, it took me a while to crawl out, man.
I can definitely relate to that. I mean, I say I woke up in 4 months. It was much more complicated than that. It took me 4 months to get to the point where I could articulate in a letter, I don't think I'm going to carry on as a JW. But even after that, there was still loads of stuff that I didn't know about the organization. I didn't know about all the scandals. I didn't know about the double standards and the hypocrisy from the organization's history. It took me ages just to read a book called Crisis of Conscience, which is basically the book that you need to read if you need to wake up from the indoctrination, because it's written by a former governing body member who really knew his stuff. And, you know, even after reading that book, you know, you're much further down the road. But again, like you say, you can't just, you know, run a marathon immediately. You have to kind of build your strength up.
I used to lump the Jehovah's Witnesses in with the Mormons when I perceived them as just sort of odd, happy people. Ah, they're harmless. Mormons and Jehovah's Witnesses, it's kind of wacky, but they're really sweet. And it was only when I began to read and learn and interview, sort of, you know, dip my foot into the waters of these cults, that I saw how insidious they really are. You've talked about a little bit of this. You mentioned the word scandal. Let's frame that around the fight that you have now. I mean, you're an activist speaking out against the Jehovah's Witnesses. What are some of the major problems? What are some of the things that people don't know? And what drives your activism?
That's a great question. So,
and it's a broad one. Please forgive how big it is. You can take that wherever you want. Okay.
Okay. So there's five major issues. One issue would probably not fix all of the other issues, but it would certainly go a way towards fixing all the other issues. There's obviously child abuse. And for anyone who's unclear on, you know, the problems surrounding Jehovah's Witnesses and child abuse, I actually made my own YouTube documentary, Jehovah's Witnesses and Child Abuse, Is There a Problem?, where I kind of spell it all out. But just very briefly, the culture of Jehovah's Witnesses and the culture of privacy and confidentiality and viewing things like pedophilia as a sin first and a crime second, all of that kind of creates a perfect storm where the conditions are ripe for child sex abuse to be covered up. And that's been found to have happened in case after case, in lawsuit after lawsuit. And just in 2015, we had a major incident in Australia where they had a royal commission that really went over the practices and policies and paperwork, you name it. They went over it with a fine-tooth comb and found out that indeed Jehovah's Witnesses do have some very damaging policies. But when they brought the officials before the commission, they even brought a governing body member before the commission, what was astonishing, it was a complete unwillingness to do anything about it, to, you know, fix some of the main issues with the child abuse policy. So that's kind of like a big one, the fact that children are at risk. There's also blood transfusions, which obviously a lot of your listeners will be familiar with. When you're a Jehovah's Witness, you are taught to think that it's preferable to die than to accept a blood transfusion. And in fact, if you don't, if you do accept a blood transfusion, well, then you're not going to get your eternal life in paradise. And that does result in many, many cases where people do die. There was a case in Canada, I think last year, of a young girl called Eloise Dupuy, who I think she was only something like 25, absolutely beautiful girl. And she died in childbirth. And what happened was, we're still kind of trying to piece together the exact chain of events. But when Jehovah's Witnesses are hospitalized, as Eloise was, they're basically sent a committee of elders called a hospital liaison committee. And it's the elders' job to basically enforce the decision and make sure that the Jehovah's Witness is essentially pressured into maintaining their stance on blood rather than buckling at the last minute, which they probably would do if they were left to their own devices. So it's a really, really insidious situation. We see it happening again and again. I've mentioned shunning, which I'll come back to shortly, but the other two issues are higher education, the fact that young Jehovah's Witnesses are told that they shouldn't go to university and college. And there's also a problem with domestic violence. So basically, Jehovah's Witness women who are in abusive relationships, and indeed men, are told that the violence of their spouse is not grounds for divorce. And that results in many, many marriages having to stay in place, even though there's abuse and there's violence. And the only way out is for one of the two spouses to commit adultery. So those are kind of the big five, but I tried to focus as much as possible on shunning because shunning has created a captive organization, and it's only since 1981 that the organization has said there is literally no graceful way of leaving the organization. So when I was first waking up from my indoctrination, there should have been a possibility for me to say, you know what, I'm done with this. You know, I've figured out that it's not for me, and you guys go right ahead. I'm not going to, you know, criticize you or anything, but I'm just done, okay? That's not possible with Jehovah's Witnesses. Since 1981, they've made it that you can't disassociate or leave of your own volition for conscientious reasons without being treated the same as if you had sinned. So, in other words, being shunned. And what that does, it means that no one's able to vote with their feet. So with all of those other issues that I've mentioned, such as blood transfusions, child abuse, higher education, witnesses are physically banned or blocked from voting with their feet and showing the leadership that they disagree. They have to stay inside the organization, whether they agree with it or not, once they're baptized, or they face having their family dismantled.
People are taking notice of your story. It's exciting to see. And you're getting feedback from people who are finding your work and sort of, you know, disconnecting from the cult and finding freedom. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. I recently had the opportunity to visit America. Obviously, there's witnesses are all over the world. But out of 8 million witnesses worldwide, probably 1 million are in the United States. So there's quite a high concentration in your country, and it was nice to get around a few cities. I went to New York, Baltimore, LA, San Francisco. I even got up to Vancouver, And it was really, really nice to meet some of the people who kind of watch the videos and visit the website and see firsthand the effects that, that kind of activism work has. I'm sure you've experienced the same thing when you attend atheist events and that kind of thing.
They feel like they've been holding their breath for a good portion of their lives, and they know they finally are getting oxygen and they want to share the experience. And, you know, it's amazing to come together with other people who are sort of busted out, you know. It's like we're all foxhole buddies who talk about the war. You know, we talk about the crazy stuff that we saw and endured, and we're like, man, it's just, it's nuts. And then we want to go help other people liberate themselves, which appears to be what drives you. Any final thoughts on all of this before I give out your website and book again?
No, just that if there are any Jehovah's Witnesses watching this, I mean, maybe they, you know, they see your channel pop up and they see Jehovah's Witnesses and they think, what on earth are they going to be talking about? I would just urge them to not be afraid that, as we were saying before, if it really is the truth, then it should hold up to scrutiny. And they should absolutely do as much research as possible, including in Watchtower's own publications. And it's worthwhile just knowing, is it true or is it not true? Because if it's not true, then it's not worth spending any time on, because life's too short.
He is author of the book, The Reluctant Apostate. His name is Lloyd Evans. What's your website again, sir?
jwsurvey.org.
And I will make sure to link all of those in the description box of this broadcast. Lloyd, you are a fantastic interview, and it's a pleasure to have met you and had this conversation. Thank you so much.
Really thrilled, Seth. Big fan. Keep up the good work.
Follow The Thinking Atheist on Facebook and Twitter. Watch dozens of original videos on The Thinking Atheist YouTube channel. And visit our website for resources, links, contact information, the editor's blog, and more. TheThinkingAtheist.com.